they were thinner, too, now, and higher, so that they never quite met, drew back in a grin of frightening intensity and unearthly boniness. "Yes, Biff, I mind." Biff recoiled for a moment, and then he nodded and leaned back in his chair again. His quaddy mocks came down on his desk again. One crossed over the other and tapped thoughtfully at the turds.
"That's fine, Bill. A man's business ought to be his own. A man's reasons ought to be his own."
"Good," Billy said. He felt the rage coming back and was grappling with it. Getting mad at this disgusting man with his quaddy mocks and his crude ethnic slurs and his blow-dried JC's haircut wasn't going to do him any good.
"Then since we agree, but it's still going to cost you $200.
"What?" Billy's mouth dropped open. For a moment, his anger was so great he was simply unable to move at all or to say anything else. This was probably just as well for Biff Quigley, because if Billy could have moved, Billy would have leapt upon him. His self-control had also lost quite a bit of weight over the last 2 months.
"Not the information I give you," Biff Quigley said. "That's a freebie. The 200's for the information I won't give them."
"Won't give who?" Billy managed.
"Your wife," Biff said, "and your doctor, and a man who says he works for an outfit called Barton Detective Services."
Billy saw everything in a flash. Things weren't as bad as his paranoid mind had imagined. They were even worse. Heidi and Mike Houston had gone to Kirk Pinchley and convinced him that Billy Halleck was mad. Pinchley was still using the Barton agency to track the gypsies, but now they were all like astronomers looking for Saturn only so they could study Titan, or bring Titan back to the Glassman Clinic. He could also see the Barton operative who had sat in this chair a few days ago talking to Biff Quigley, telling him that a very skinny man named Bill Halleck was going to show up soon, and when he did, this was the number to call. This was followed by an even clearer vision. He saw himself leaping across Biff Quigley's desk, seizing the bronzed pile of dog turds in mid-leap, and then bashing Biff Quigley's head in with them. He saw this in utter savage clarity, the skin breaking, the blood flying up in a fine spray of droplets, some of them splashing on the framed pictures, the white glimmer of bone shattering to reveal the physical texture of the man's creepy mind. Then he saw himself slamming the dog turds back where they belonged, where, in a manner of speaking, they had come from. Quigley must have seen this, or some of it, on Billy's haggard face, for an expression of alarm appeared on his own face. He hurriedly removed his feet from his desk and his hands from behind his neck. The chair emitted its mechanical pig squeal again.
"Now we could talk this over," he began, and Billy saw one manicured hand straying toward the intercom.
Billy's anger abruptly deflated, leaving him shaken and cold. He had just visualized beating the man's brains out, not in any vague way, but in the mental equivalent of Technicolor and Dolby sound. And good old Biff had known he was doing it, too.
"Whatever happened to the old Bill Halleck, who used to give to the United Fund and make wassail on Christmas Eve?"
His mind returned. Yeah, that was the Billy Halleck that lived in Fat City. He moved. Gone. No forwarding.
"No need for that," Billy said, nodding at the intercom. The hand jerked, then diverted to a desk drawer, as if that had been its objective all the time.
Biff brought out a pack of cigarettes.
"Wasn't even thinking of it. Smoke, Mr. Halleck?"
Billy took one, looked at it, and then leaned forward to get a light. One drag, and he was lightheaded.
"Thanks." "About the 200, maybe I was wrong."
"No, you were right," Billy said. He had cashed $300 worth of traveler's checks on his way over here, thinking it might be necessary to grease the skids a little. But it had never occurred to him that he might have to grease them for such a reason as this. He took out his wallet, removed 450s, and tossed them onto Biff's desk beside the dog turds. "You'll keep your mouth shut when Pinchley calls you."
"Oh, yes, sir." Biff took the money and put it into the drawer with the cigarettes. "You know it."
I hope I do, Billy said. Now, tell me about the gypsies. It was short and easy to follow. The only really complicated part had been the preliminaries. The gypsies had arrived in Bangor on June 10th. Samuel Lemke, the young juggler, and a man who answered the description of Richard Crosskill had come to Biff's office. After a call to Mr. Parsons and one to the Bangor chief of police, Richard Crosskill had signed a standard short-term renewable lease form. The short-term, in this case, was specified to be 24 hours. Crosskill signed as secretary of the Tadus Corporation, while young Lemke stood by the door of Biff's office with his muscular arms crossed. "And just how much silver did they cross your palm with?" Billy asked. Biff raised his eyebrows. "Beg your pardon?" "You got 200 from me, probably 100 from my concerned wife and friends via the Bartnop who visited you. I just wondered how much the gypsies coughed up. You've done pretty well out of this any way you cut it, haven't you, Biff?" Biff said nothing for a moment. Then, without answering Billy's question, he finished his story. Crosskill had come back on the two following days to re-sign the lease agreement. On the 13th, he arrived again. But by then, Biff had had a call from the chief of police and from Parsons. The complaints from the local citizenry had begun. The chief thought it was time for the gypsies to move on. Parsons thought the same, but he would be willing to let them stay another day or so if they wanted to up the ante a bit, say from $30 a night to 50. Crosskill listened to this and shook his head. He left without speaking. On a whim, Biff had driven out to the burned-out shell of the bargain barn that noon. He was in time to see the gypsy caravan pulling out. "They headed for the Chamberlain Bridge," he said, "and that's all I know. Why don't you get out of here now, Bill? To be honest, you look like an advertisement for a vacation in Biafra. Looking at you sort of gives me the creeps." Billy was still holding the cigarette, although he hadn't taken a puff since the first drag. Now he leaned forward and butted it on the bronze dog turds. It felt smoldering to Biff's desk. "To be honest," he said to Biff, "I feel exactly the same way about you." The rage was back on him. He walked quickly out of Bill Quigley's office before it could move him in the wrong direction or make his hands speak in some terrible language they seemed to know. It was the 24th of June. The gypsies had left Bangor via the Chamberlain Bridge on the 13th. Now he was only 11 days behind. Closer. Closer. But still too far. He discovered that Route 15, which began on the Brewer side of the bridge, was known as the Bar Harbor Road. It looked as if he might be going there after all. But along the way he would speak to no more realtors and stay at no more first-class motels. If the Barton people were still ahead of him, Kirk might well have put more people on the lookout for him. The gypsies had driven the 44 miles to Ellsworth on the 13th and had been granted a permit to camp on the fairgrounds for 3 days. Then they had crossed the Penobscot River to Bucksport, or they had stayed another 3 days before moving on toward the coast again. Billy discovered all of this on the 25th. The gypsies had left Bucksport late on the afternoon of June 19. Now he was only a week behind them. Bar Harbor was as crazily booming as the waitress had told him it would be, and Billy thought she had also at least suggested some of the resort town's essential wrongness. The main drag. Until after Labor Day, it's a street carnival. Most of these towns are like that, but Bar Harbor is like top end, you know? I used to go up there sometimes in July or August and hang out, but not anymore. I'm too old for that now. Me too, Billy thought, sitting on a park bench in cotton pants, a T-shirt which read, "Bangor's Got Soul," and a sport coat that hung straight down from the bony rack of his shoulders. He was eating an ice cream cone and drawing too many glances. He was tired, and he was alarmed to find that he was always tired now, unless he was in the grip of one of his rages. When he parked the car and got out this morning to begin flashing the pictures, he'd experienced a moment of nightmarish déjà vu as his pants began to slide down his hips. "Excusez-moi," he thought, "as they slid down my non-hips." The pants were corduroys he had bought in the Rockland Army Navy store. They had a 28-inch waist. The clerk had told him a little nervously that he was going to run into trouble buying off-the-rack pants pretty soon, because he was almost into the boy waist sizes now. His leg size, however, was still 32, and there just weren't that many 13-year-olds who stood 6 feet 2 inches tall. Now he sat eating a pistachio ice cream cone, waiting for some of his strength to come back, and trying to decide what was so distressing about this beautiful little town where you couldn't park your car and where you could barely walk on the sidewalks. Old Orcher had been vulgar, but his vulgarity had been straightforward and somehow exhilarating. You knew the prizes to be won in the pitch-till-you-win booths were junk that would fall apart immediately, that the souvenirs were junk that would fall apart at almost the exact moment you got too far away to turn around and go back and bitch until they gave you your money back. In Old Orchard, many of the women were old, and almost all of them were fat. Some wore obscenely small bikinis, but most wore tank suits that seemed relics of the 1950s. You felt, passing these jiggling women on the boardwalk, that those suits were under the same terrible pressures as a submarine cruising far below her rated depth. If any of that iridescent miracle fabric gave way, fat would fly. The smells in the air had been pizza, ice cream, frying onions, every now and then the nervous vomit of some little kid who had stayed on the tilt-a-whirl too long. Most of the cars, which cruised slowly up and down in the bumper-to-bumper Old Orchard traffic, had been old, rusty around the bottom of the doors, and usually too big. Many of them had been blowing oil. Old Orchard had been vulgar, but had also had a certain peeling innocence that seemed missing in Bar Harbor. Here so many things were the exact reverse of Old Orchard that Billy felt a little as if he had stepped through the looking-glass, that there were few old women and apparently no fat women, hardly any women wearing bathing suits. The Bar Harbor uniform seemed to be tennis dress and white sneakers or faded jeans, rugby shirts and boatnicks. Billy saw few old cars, and even fewer American cars. Most were Saabs, Volvos, Datsuns, BMWs, Hondas. All of them had bumper stickers saying things like, "Split wood, not atoms," and "U.S. out of El Salvador," and "Legalize the weed." The bike people were here, too. They wove in and out of the slowly moving downtown throngs on expensive 10-speeds, wearing polarized sunglasses and sun visors, flashing their orthodontically perfect smiles and listening to Sony Walkmen. Below town, in the harbor itself, a forest of masts grew. Not the thick, dull-colored masts of working boats, but the slim white ones of sailboats that would be dry-docked after Labor Day. The people hanging out in Bar Harbor were young, brainy, fashionably liberal and rich. They also partied all night long, apparently. Billy had phoned ahead to make a reservation at the Frenchman's Bay Motel, and had lain awake until the small hours of the morning, listening to conflicting rock music pouring from 6 or 8 different bars. The tally of wrecked cars and traffic violations, mostly DWIs, in the local paper was impressive and a little disheartening. Billy watched the Frisbee fly over the crowds in their preppy clothes and thought, "You want to know why this place and these people depress you? I'll tell you. They are studying to live in places like Fairview, that's why. They'll finish school, get married to women who will conclude their first affairs and rounds of analysis at roughly the same time, and settle down on the lantern drives of America. There they will wear red pants when they play golf, and each and every New Year's Eve will be the occasion of much tit-grabbing." "Yeah, that's depressing, all right," he muttered, and a couple passing by looked at him strangely. "They're still here." Yes, they were still here. The thought was so natural, so positive, that it was neither surprising nor particularly exciting. He had been a week behind them. They could be up in the Maritimes by now or halfway down the coast again. Their previous pattern suggested they would be gone by now, and certainly Bar Harbor, where even the souvenir shops looked like expensive East Side auction rooms, was a little too tony to put up with a rag-taggle band of gypsies for long. All very true. Except they were still here, and he knew it. "Old man, I smell you," he whispered. "Of course you smell 'em. You are supposed to." The thought caused a moment's unease. Then he got up, tossed the remainder of his cone into a trash barrel, and walked back to the ice cream vendor. The vendor did not seem particularly pleased to see Billy returning.
"I wonder if you could help me," Billy said.
"No, man, I really don't think so," the vendor said, and Billy saw the revulsion in his eyes.
"You might be surprised." Billy felt a sense of deep calm and predestination. Not deja vu, but real predestination.
The ice cream vendor wanted to turn away, but Billy held him with his own eyes. He found he was capable of that now, as if he himself had become some sort of supernatural creature. He took out the packet of photographs. It was now rumpled and sweat-stained. He dealt out the familiar tarot hand of images, lining them up along the counter of the man's booth. The vendor looked at them, and Billy felt no surprise at the recognition in the man's eyes, no pleasure, only that faint fear, like pain waiting to happen when the local anesthetic wears off. There was a clear salt tang in the air, and gulls were crying over the harbor.
"This guy," the ice cream vendor said, staring fascinated at the photograph of Tadus Lemke. "This guy? What a spook!
Are they still around?"
"Yeah," the ice cream vendor said. "Yeah, I think they are. The cops kicked them out of town the second day, but they were able to rent a field from a farmer in Technor. That's one town inland from here. I've seen them around. The cops have gotten to the point where they're writing them up for broken taillights and stuff like that. You'd think they'd take the hint."
"Thank you." He began to collect his pictures again.
"You want another ice cream?"
"No, thank you." The fear was stronger now, but the anger was there too, a buzzing, pulsing tone under everything else.
"Then would you mind just sort of rambling on, mister? You're not particularly good for business."
"No," Billy said, "I suppose I'm not." He headed back toward his car. The tiredness had left him. That night, at 9:15, Billy parked his rental car on the soft shoulder of Route 37A, which leaves Bar Harbor to the northwest. He was on top of a hill, and a sea breeze blew around him, ruffling his hair and making his loose clothes flap on his body. From behind him, carried on that breeze, came the sound of tonight's rock and roll party starting to crank up in Bar Harbor. Below him, to the right, he could see a large campfire surrounded by cars and trucks and vans. Closer in were the people. Every now and then one of them strolled in front of the fire, a black cardboard cutout. He could hear conversation, occasional laughter. He had caught up.
"The old man is down there waiting for you, Billy. He knows you're here."
"Yes. Yes, of course." The old man could have pulled his little band right off the edge of the world, at least as far as Billy Halleck would have been able to tell, if he had wanted. But that hadn't been his pleasure. Instead, he had taken Billy over the jumps from Old Orchard to here. That had been what he wanted. The fear again, drifting like smoke through his hollow places. There were so many hollow places in him now, it seemed. But the rage was still there, too. "It's what I wanted, too. And I may just surprise him. The fear I'm sure he expects. The anger. That may be a surprise."
Billy looked back at the car for a moment, then shook his head. He started down the grassy side of the hill toward the fire.
He paused in the back of the camper with the unicorn and the maiden on the side, a narrow shadow among other shadows, but more constant than those thrown by the shifting flames. He stood there listening to their quiet conversation, the occasional burst of laughter, the pop of an exploding knot in the fire. "I can't go out there," his mind insisted, with utter certainty. There was fear in this certainty, but also intertwined in it were inarticulate feelings of shame and propriety. He no more wanted to break into the concentric circles of their campfire and their talk and their privacy than he had wanted to have his pants fall down in Hilmer Boynton's courtroom. He, after all, was the offender. He was... Then Linda's face rose up in his mind. He heard her asking him to come home and beginning to cry as she did. He was the offender, yes, but he was not the only one. The rage began to come up in him again. He clamped down on it, tried to compress it, to turn it into something a little more useful. Simple sternness would be enough, he thought. Then he walked between the camper and the station wagon parked next to it, his Gucci loafers whispering in the dry timothy grass and into their midst. There really were concentric circles. First, the rough circle of vehicles, and inside that, a circle of men and women sitting around the fire, which burned in a dug hollow surrounded by a circle of stones. Nearby, a cut branch about 6 feet tall had been stuck into the earth. A yellow sheet of paper, a campfire permit, Billy supposed, was impaled on its tip. The younger men and women sat on the flattened grass or on air mattresses. Many of the older people were sitting on lawn chairs made of tubular aluminum and woven plastic strips. Billy saw one old woman sitting propped up on pillows in a lounger, a blanket tucked around her. She was smoking a home-rolled cigarette and sticking S&H green stamps in a trading stamp book. Three dogs on the far side of the fire began to bark half-heartedly. One of the younger men looked up sharply and drew back one side of his vest, revealing a nickel-plated revolver in a shoulder holster. "Henkelt," one of the older said sharply, putting his hand on the young man's hand. "Bodehar? Just det. Hanaktados." The young man looked toward Billy Halleck, who now stood in the midst of them, totally out of place in his baggy sport coat and city shoes. There was a look not of fear, but momentary surprise, and, Billy would have sworn it, compassion on his face. Then he was gone, pausing only long enough to administer a kick to one of the hounds and growl, "Enkelt!" The hound yipped once, and then they all shut up. Gone to get the old man, Billy thought. He looked around at them. All conversation had ceased. They regarded him with their dark gypsy eyes, and no one said a word. "This is how it feels when your pants really do fall down in court," he thought, but that wasn't a bit true. Now that he was actually in front of them, the complexity of his emotions had disappeared. The fear was there, and the anger, but both idled quietly somewhere deep inside. "And there's something else. They're not surprised to see you. And they're not surprised at how you look, either." Then it was true, all true. No psychological anorexia, no exotic form of cancer. Billy thought that even Michael Houston would have been convinced by those dark eyes. They knew what had happened to him. They knew why it was happening. And they knew how it would end. They stared at each other, the gypsies and the thin man from Fairview, Connecticut, and suddenly, for no reason at all, Billy began to grin. The old woman with the trading stamps moaned and forked the sign of the evil eye at him. Approaching footsteps and a young woman's voice, speaking rapidly and angrily.
"Vatsahan, hok plutslik breast han dibuk, papa. Alasin grantind, snala dibuk, tu meg mama."
Tados Lemka, dressed in a nightshirt which fell to his bony knees, stepped barefoot into the light of the campfire. Next to him, wearing a cotton nightgown that rounded sweetly against her hips as she walked, was Gina Lemka.
"Tamig, mama! Tamig!"
She caught sight of Billy standing in the center of the circle, his sport coat hanging, the seat of his pants bagging to almost below the coat's hem. She flung a hand up in his direction and then turned back to the old man as if to attack him. The others watched in silent impassivity. Another knot exploded in the fire. Sparks spiraled up in a tiny cyclone.
"Tamig, mama, va dibuk! Tamig inte tel momor, odor vudelak!"
"Sahan lakt, Gina," the old man replied.
His face and voice were both serene. One of his twisted hands stroked the smooth black flood of her hair, which fell to her waist. So far, Tadus Lemke had not looked at Billy at all.
Viskastana.
For a moment she sagged, and in spite of the lush curves, she seemed very young to Billy. Then she wheeled toward him again, her face rekindling. It was as if someone had thrown a shot of gasoline onto a dying fire.
"You don't understand our lingo, mister!" she screamed at him. "I say to my old papa that you killed my old mama. I say you are a demon and we should kill you!"
The old man put a hand on her arm. She shook it free and rushed at Billy, barely skirting the campfire on flying bare feet. Her hair streamed out behind her.
"Gina, for Kliegenglad!"
someone cried, alarmed, but no one else spoke. The old man's serene expression did not change. He watched Gina approach Billy as an indulgent parent watches a wayward child. She spat on him, an enormous amount of warm white spittle, as if her mouth had been full of it. Billy could taste some of it on his lips. It tasted like tears. She looked up at him with her enormous dark eyes, and in spite of all that had happened, in spite of how much he had lost of himself, he was aware that he still wanted her. And she knew it, too, he realized. The darkness in her eyes was mostly contempt. "If it would bring her back, you could spit on me until I drowned in it," he said. His voice was surprisingly clear and strong. "But I'm not a Dibbuk. Not a Dibbuk. Not a demon, not a monster. What you see..." He raised his arms, and for a moment the firelight shone through his coat, making him look like a large but very malnourished white bat. He slowly lowered his hands to his sides again. "Is all that I am." For a moment she looked uncertain, almost fearful. Although her spittle was still trickling down his face, the contempt had left her eyes, and Billy was wearily grateful for that.
"Gina!"
It was Samuel Lemke, the juggler. He had appeared beside the old man and was still buckling his pants. He wore a T-shirt with a picture of Bruce Springsteen on it.
"Enkelt menten raklicht!"
"You are a murdering bastard,"
she said to Billy, and walked back the way she had come. Her brother attempted to put an arm around her, but she shook him off and disappeared into the shadows. The old man turned to watch her go, and then at last he turned his gaze on Billy Halleck. For a moment Billy stared at the festering hole in the middle of Lemke's face, and then his eyes were drawn to the man's eyes. The eyes of age, had he thought? They were something more than that, and something less. It was emptiness he saw in them. It was emptiness which was their fundamental truth, not the surface awareness that gleamed on them like moonlight on dark water. Emptiness as deep and complete as the spaces which may lie between galaxies. Lemke crooked a finger at Billy, and, as if in a dream, Billy walked slowly around the campfire to where the old man stood in his dark gray nightshirt.
"Do you know Rome?"
Lemke asked, when Billy stood directly in front of him. His tone was almost intimate, but it carried clearly in the silent camp, where the only sound was the fire eating into dry wood. Billy shook his head.
"In Rome we call you Scumare Ignum, which means white man from town."
He grinned, showing rotted, tobacco-stained teeth. The dark hole where his nose had been stretched and writhed.
"But it also means how it sounds. Ignorant scum."
Now his eyes finally let Billy's eyes go. Lemke seemed to lose all interest.
"Go on now, white man from town. You have no business with us, and we have no business with you. If we had business, it is done. Go back to your town."
He began to turn away. For a moment, Billy only stood there with his mouth open, dimly realizing that the old man had hypnotized him. He had done it as easily as a farmer makes a chicken go to sleep by tucking its head under its wing.
"That's it?"
part of him suddenly screamed. "All of the driving,
All of the walking, all of the questions, all of the bad dreams, all of the days and nights, and that's it? You're just going to stand here without saying a word? Just let him call you ignorant scum and then go back to bed?
No, that is not it, Billy said in a rough, loud voice.
Someone drew in a harsh, surprised breath. Samuel Lemke, who had been helping the old man toward the back of one of the campers, looked around, startled. After a moment, Lemke himself turned around. His face was wearily amused, but Billy thought for just a moment, just as the firelight touched his face, he had seen surprise there as well. Nearby, the young man who had first seen Billy reached under his vest again to where his revolver hung.
"She's very beautiful," Billy said.
"Gina."
"Shut up, white man from town," Samuel Lemke said. "I don't want to hear my sister's name come out your mouth."
Billy ignored him. He looked at Lemke instead.
"Is she your granddaughter?
Great-granddaughter?" The old man studied him, as if trying to decide whether or not something might be here after all, some sound other than the wind in the hollow ground. Then he began to turn away again.
"Perhaps you'd wait just a minute while I write down my own daughter's address," Billy said, raising his voice.
He did not raise it much, but he did not need to in order to bring out its imperative edge, an edge he had honed in a good many courtrooms.
"She's not as lovely as your Gina, but we think she's very pretty. Perhaps they could correspond on the subject of injustice. What do you think, Lemke? Will they be able to talk about that after I'm as dead as your daughter? Who was able to finally sort out where an injustice really lay? Children? Grandchildren? Just a minute. I'll write down the address. It'll only take a second. I'll put it on the back of a photograph I have of you. If they can't figure this mess out, maybe they can get together some day and shoot each other, and then their kids can give it a try. What do you think, old man? Does that make any more sense than this shit?"
Samuel put an arm on Lemke's shoulder. Lemke shook it off and walked slowly back to where Billy stood. Now Lemke's eyes were filled with tears of fury. His knotted hands slowly opened and closed. All the others watched, silent and frightened.
"You run my daughter over in the road, white man," he said. "You run my daughter over in the road, and then you have... You are Borjadarula enough to come here and speak out of your mouth to my ear? Hey, I know who done what. I taken care of it. Mostly we turn and we drive out of town. Mostly, yeah, we do that. But sometimes we get our justice."
The old man raised his gnarled hand in front of Billy's eyes. Suddenly, it snapped into a closed fist. A moment later, blood began to drip from it. From the others came a mutter, not of fear or surprise, but approval.
"Rum justice. Skomade ignom. The other two I take care of already. The judge... He jump out of a window 2 nights ago. He is..."
Taduz Lemke snapped his fingers and then blew on the ball of his thumb as if it were a seedling dandelion.
"Did that bring your daughter back, Mr. Lemke? Did she come back when Carrie Rossington hit the ground out there in Minnesota?"
Lemke's lips twisted.
"I don't need her back. Justice ain't bringing the dead back, white man. Justice is justice. You want to get out of here before I fix you with something else. I know what you and your woman were up to. You think I don't have the sight? I got the sight. You ask any of them. I got the sight 100 years.
There was an assenting murmur from those around the fire.
"I don't care how long you've had the sight," Billy said. He reached out deliberately and grasped the old man's shoulders. From somewhere there was a growl of rage. Samuel Lemke started forward. Taduz Lemke turned his head and spat a single word in Romani. The younger man stopped, uncertain and confused. There were similar expressions on many of the faces around the campfire, but Billy did not see this.
he saw only Lemke. He leaned toward him closer and closer until his nose almost touched the wrinkled, spongy mess that was all that remained of Lemke's nose. "Fuck your justice," he said. "You know about as much about justice as I know about jet turbines. Take it off me."
Lemke's eyes stared up into Billy's, that horrible emptiness just below the intelligence.
"Let go of me, or I'll make it worse," he said calmly. "So much worse, you think I blessed you the first time."
The grin suddenly broke on Billy's face, the bony grin which looked like a crescent moon that had been pushed over on its back.
"Go ahead," he said. "Try. But you know, I don't think you can."
The old man stared at him wordlessly.
"Because I helped do it to myself," Billy said. "They were right about that much, anyway. It's a partnership, isn't it? The cursed and the one who does the cursing. We are all in it with you together, Hopley, Rossington, and me. But I am opting out, old man. My wife was jerking me off in my big old expensive car, right, and your daughter came out between two parked cars in the middle of the block like any ordinary jaywalker, and that's right, too. If she had crossed at the corner, she would be alive now. There was fault on both sides, but she's dead, and I can never go back to what my life was before. It balances. Not the best balance in the history of the world, maybe, but it balances. They've got a way of saying it in Las Vegas. They call it a push. This is a push, old man. Let it end here."
A strange and almost alien fear had arisen in Lemke's eyes when Billy began to smile, but now his anger, stony and obdurate, replaced it.
"I never take it off, white man from town," Tadeusz Lemke said. "I die with it in my mouth."
Billy slowly brought his face down on Lemke's until their foreheads touched and he could smell the old man's odor. It was the smell of cobwebs and tobacco and dim urine.
"Then make it worse. Go ahead. Make it, how did you say? Like you blessed me the first time."
Lemke looked at him for a moment longer, and now Billy sensed it was Lemke who was the one caught. Then suddenly Lemke turned his head to Samuel.
"En keltav lakin un kanski alskad. Just det."
Samuel Lemke and the young man with the pistol under his vest tore Billy away from Tadeusz Lemke. The old man's shallow chest rose and fell rapidly. His scant hair was disarrayed.
He's not used to being touched, not used to being spoken to in anger.
"It's a push," Billy said as they pulled him away. "Do you hear me?"
Lemke's face twisted. Suddenly, horribly, he was 300 years old, a terrible living revenant.
"No push," he cried at Billy and shook his fist. "No push, not never. You die, teen town man, you die like this."
He brought his fists together, and Billy felt a sharp stabbing pain in his sides, as if he had been between those fists. For a moment, he could not get his breath, and felt as if all his guts were being squeezed together.
"You die, teen!"
"It's a push," Billy said again, struggling not to gasp.
"No push!"
the old man screamed. In his fury at this continued contradiction, thin red color had crisscrossed his cheeks in net-like patterns.
"Get him out of here!"
They began to drag him back across the circle. Tadeusz Lemke stood watching, his hands on his hips and his face a stone mask.
"Before they take me away, old man, you ought to know my own curse will fall on your family," Billy called, and in spite of all the dull pain in his sides, his voice was strong, calm, almost cheerful.
"The curse of the white men from town."
Lemke's eyes widened slightly, he thought. From the corner of his eye, Billy saw the old woman with the trading stamps in her blanketed lap fork the sign of the evil eye at him again. The two young men stopped pulling him for a moment. Samuel Lemke uttered a short, bewildered laugh, perhaps at the idea of a white, upper-middle-class lawyer from Fairview, Connecticut, cursing a man who was probably the oldest gypsy in America. Billy himself would have laughed 2 months ago. Tadus Lemke, however, was not laughing. "You think men like me don't have the power to curse?" Billy asked. He held his hands, his thin, wasted hands, up on either side of his face and slowly splayed the fingers. He looked like a variety show host asking an audience to end their applause. "We have the power. We're good at cursing once we get started, old man. Don't make me start." There was movement behind the old man, a flash of white nightgown and black hair. "Gina!" Samuel Lemke cried out. Billy saw her step forward into the light, saw her raise the slingshot, draw the cradle back, and release it all in the same smooth gesture, like an artist drawing a line on a blank pad. He thought he saw a liquid, streaky gleam in the air as the steel ball flew across the circle, but that was almost certainly just imagination. There was a hot, glassy spear of pain in his left hand. It was gone almost as soon as it came. He heard the steel ball bearing she had fired thwang off the steel side of a van. At the same moment, he realized he could see the girl's drawn, furious face, not framed in his spread fingers, but through his palm, where there was a neat, round hole. "She slingshotted me," he thought. "Holy Christ, she did!" Blood, black as tar in the firelight, ran down the pad of his palm and soaked the sleeve of his sport coat.
"Enkelt," she screamed. "Get out of here, Eilik! Get out of here, killing bastard!"
She threw the slingshot. It landed at the edge of the fire, a wishbone shape with a rubber cup the size of an eye patch caught in its fork. Then she fled, shrieking. No one moved. Those around the fire, the two young men, the old man, and Billy himself, all of them stood in tableau. There was the slam of a door, and the girl's shrieks were muffled. And still there was no pain. Suddenly, not even knowing he meant to do it, Billy held his bleeding hand out toward Lemke. The old man flinched back and forked the sign of the evil eye at Billy. Billy closed his hand as Lemke had done. Blood ran from his closed fist as it had run from Lemke's closed fist. "The curse of the white man is on you, Mr. Lemke. They don't write about that one in books, but I'm telling you it's true. And you believe that." The old man screamed the flood of Romany. Billy felt himself hauled backward so suddenly that his head snapped on his neck. His feet left the ground. "They're going to throw me in the fire. Christ, they're going to roast me in it." Instead, he was carried back the way he had come. Through the circle, people fell out of their chairs, scrambling away from him, and between two pickups with camper caps. From one of them, Billy heard a TV crackling out something with a laugh track. The man in the vest grunted. Billy was swung like a sack of grain, a very underweight sack of grain, and then for a moment he was flying. He landed in the timothy grass beyond the parked vehicles with a thud. This hurt a good deal more than the hole in his hand. There were no padded places on him anymore, and he felt his bones rattle inside his body like loose stakes in an old truck. He tried to get up, and at first could not. White lights danced in front of his eyes. He groaned. Samuel Lemke came toward him. The boy's handsome face was smooth and deadly and expressionless. He reached into the pocket of his jeans and brought out something. Billy at first thought it was a stick, and only recognized it for what it was when Lemke unfolded the blade. He held his bleeding hand out, palm up, and Lemke hesitated. Now there was an expression on his face, one Billy recognized from his own bathroom mirror. It was fear. His companion muttered something to him. Lemke hesitated for a moment, looking down at Billy. Then he refolded the blade into the knife's dark body. He spat in Billy's direction. A moment later, the two of them were gone. He lay there for a moment, trying to reconstruct everything, to make some sense of it. But that was a lawyer's trick, and it would not serve him here in this dark place. His hand was starting to talk very loudly about what had happened to it now, and he thought that very soon it would hurt a lot more. Unless, of course, they changed their minds and came back here for him. Then they might end all hurting in very short order, and forever. That got him moving. He rolled over, slid his knees up to what was left of his stomach, then paused there a moment with his left cheek pressed against the beaten Timothy and his ass in the air, while a wave of faintness and nausea rode through him like a breaking wave. When it passed, he was able to get to his feet and start up the hill to where his car was parked. He fell down twice on the way. The second time, he believed it was going to be impossible to get to his feet again. Somehow, mostly by thinking about Linda, sleeping quietly and blamelessly in her bed, he was able to do it. Now his hand felt as if a dark red infection was pulsing in it and working its way up his forearm toward his elbow. An endless time later, he reached the rental Ford and scrabbled for the keys. He had put them in his left pocket, and so he had to reach across his crotch with his right hand to get at them. He started the car and paused for a moment, his screaming hand lying palm up on his left thigh like a bird that had been shot. He looked down at the circle of vans and campers and the twinkle of the fire. A ghost of some old song came to him. She danced around the fire to a gypsy melody. Sweet young woman in motion, how she enchanted me. He lifted his left hand slowly in front of his face. Ghostly green light from the car's instrument panel spilled through the round dark hole in his palm. She enchanted me, all right, Billy thought, and dropped the car in drive. He wondered, with almost clinical detachment, if he would be able to make it back to the Frenchman's Bay Motel. Somehow, he did.
William, what's wrong?
Ginelli's voice, which had been deeply blurred with sleep and ready to be angry, was now sharp with concern. Billy had found Ginelli's home number in his address book below the one for Three Brothers. He had dialed it without much hope at all. Sure, it would have been changed at some point during the intervening years. His left hand, wrapped in a handkerchief, lay in his lap. It had turned into something like a radio station and was now broadcasting approximately 50,000 watts of pain. The slightest movement sent it raving up his arm. Beads of sweat stood out on his forehead. Images of crucifixion kept occurring to him. "I'm sorry to call you at home, Richard," he said. "And so late."
"Fuck that. What's wrong?"
"Well, the immediate problem is that I've been shot through the hand with a..." He shifted slightly, his hand flared, and his lips peeled back over his teeth. "With a ball bearing." Silence at the other end. "I know how it sounds, but it's true. The woman used the slingshot."
"Jesus! What?"
A woman's voice in the background. Ginelli spoke briefly in Italian to her and then came back on the line.
"This is no joke, William. Some whore put a ball bearing through your hand with a slingshot?"
"I don't call people at..." He looked at his watch, and another flare of pain raced up his arm. "At 3 o'clock in the morning and tell jokes. I've been sitting here for the last 3 hours, trying to wait until a more civilized hour. But the pain..." He laughed a little, a hurt, helpless, bewildered sound. "The pain is very bad."
"Does this have to do with what you called me about before?"
"Yes."
"It was gypsies?"
"Yes, Richard."
"Yeah? Well, I promise you one thing. They don't fuck with you anymore after this.
Richard, I can't go to a doctor with this, and I really am in a lot of pain.
Billy Halleck, grand master of understatement, he thought.
Can you send me something, maybe by Federal Express, some kind of painkiller?
Where are you?
Billy hesitated for just a moment, then shook his head a little. Everyone he trusted had decided he was crazy. He thought it very likely that his wife and his boss had gone through, or soon would be going through, the motions necessary to effect an involuntary committal in the state of Connecticut. Now his choices were very simple and marvelously ironic. Either trust this dope-dealing hood he hadn't seen in nearly 6 years, or give up completely. Closing his eyes, he said, "I'm in Bar Harbor, Maine, the Frenchman's Bay Motel, Unit 37.
Just a second.
Ginelli's voice moved away from the telephone again. Billy heard him speaking in a dim platter of Italian. He didn't open his eyes. At last, Ginelli came back on the line again.
"My wife is making a couple of calls for me," he said. "You're waking up guys in Norwalk right now, Paisan. I hope you're satisfied."
"You're a gentleman, Richard," Billy said. The words came out in a guttural slur, and he had to clear his throat. He felt too cold. His lips were too dry, and he tried to wet them, but his tongue was dry, too.
"You be very still, my friend," Ginelli said.
The concern was back in his voice.
"You hear me? Very still. Wrap up in a blanket if you want, but that's all. You've been shot. You're in shock."
"No shit," Billy said and laughed again. "I've been in shock for about 2 months now."
"What are you talking about?"
"Never mind."
"All right. But we gotta talk, William."
"Yes."
Hold on a second."
Italian, soft and faint. Halleck closed his eyes again and listened to his hand broadcast pain. After a while, Ginelli came back on the phone.
"A man is going to come by with some painkiller for you.
Oh, hey, Richard, that's not..."
"Don't tell me my business, William. Just listen. His name is Fander. He's no doctor, this guy, at least not anymore. But he's going to look at you and decide if you ought to have some antibiotics as well as the dope. He'll be there before daylight."
"Richard, I don't know how to thank you," Billy said. Tears were running down his cheeks. He wiped at them absently with his right hand.
"I know you don't," Ginelli said. "You're not a wop. Remember, Richard, just sit still."
Fander arrived shortly before 6 o'clock. He was a little man with prematurely white hair who carried a country doctor's bag. He gazed at Billy's scrawny, emaciated body for a long moment, without speaking, and then carefully unwound the handkerchief from Billy's left hand. Billy had to put his other hand over his mouth to stifle a scream.
"Raise it, please," Fander said, and Billy did.
The hand was badly swollen, the skin pulled taut and shiny. For a moment, he and Fander gazed at each other through the hole in Billy's palm, which was ringed with dark blood. Fander took an otoscope from his bag and shone it through the wound. Then he turned it off.
"Clean and neat," he said. "If it was a ball bearing, there's much less chance of infection than there would have been with a lead slug."
He paused, considering.
"Unless, of course, the girl put something on it before she fired it."
"What a comforting idea," Billy croaked.
"I'm not paid to comfort people," Fander said coolly. "Especially when I'm routed out of bed at 3:30 and have to change from my pajamas into my clothes in a light plane that is bouncing around at 11,000 feet. You say it was a steel bearing?"
"Yes."
"Then you're probably all right. You can't very well soak a steel ball bearing in poison the way the Jivaro Indians soak their wooden arrowheads in Karari, and it doesn't seem likely the woman could have painted it with anything if it was all as spur of the moment as you say. This should heal well, with no complications."
He took out disinfectant, gauze, and elastic bandage.
"I'm going to pack the wound and then bandage it. The packing is going to hurt like hell, but believe me when I tell you that it's going to hurt a lot more in the long run if I leave it open."
He cast another measuring eye on Billy. Not so much the compassionate eye of a doctor, Billy thought, as the cold, appraising glance of an abortionist.
"This hand is going to be the least of your problems if you don't start eating again."
Billy said nothing. Fander looked at him a moment longer, then began packing the wound. At that point, talk would have been impossible for Billy anyway. The pain broadcasting station in his hand jumped from 50,000 to 250,000 watts in one quick leap. He closed his eyes, clamped his teeth together, and waited for it to be over. At last, it was over. He sat with his throbbing, bandaged hand in his lap and watched Fander root in his bag once more.
"All other considerations aside, your radical emaciation makes for problems when it comes to dealing with your pain. You're going to feel quite a bit more discomfort than you'd feel if your weight was normal, I'm afraid. I can't give you Darvon or Darvocet because they might put you in a coma or cause you to go into cardiac arrhythmia. How much do you weigh, Mr. Halleck? 125?
"About that," Billy muttered. There was a scale in the bathroom, and he had stepped on it before going out to the camp of the gypsies. It was his own bizarre form of pep rally, he supposed. The needle had centered on 118. All the running around in the hot summer sun had helped to speed things up considerably. Fander nodded with a little moo of distaste.
"I'm going to give you some fairly strong Emprin. You take one single tablet. If you're not dozing off in half an hour, and if your hand is still very, very painful, you can take another half. And you go on like that for the next 3 or 4 days."
He shook his head.
"I just flew 600 miles to give a man a bottle of Emprin. I can't believe it. Life can be very perverse. But considering your weight, even Emprin's dangerous. It ought to be baby aspirin."
Fander removed another small bottle from his bag, this one unmarked.
"Oreomycin," he said. "Take one by mouth every 6 hours. But, mark this well, Mr. Halleck, if you start having diarrhea, stop the antibiotic at once. In your state, diarrhea is a lot more apt to kill you than an infection from this wound."
He snapped the bag shut and stood up.
"One final piece of advice that has nothing to do with your adventures in the Maine countryside. Get some potassium tablets as soon as possible and begin taking 2 every day, one when you get up, one when you go to bed. You'll find them at the drugstore in the vitamin section."
"Why?"
"If you continue to lose weight, you will very soon begin to experience instances of heart arrhythmia, whether you take Darvon or any other drug. This sort of arrhythmia comes from radical potassium depletion in the body. It may have been what killed Karen Carpenter. Good day, Mr. Halleck."
Fander let himself out into the first mild light of dawn. For a moment, he only stood there looking toward the sound of the ocean, which was very clear in the stillness.
"You really ought to get off whatever hunger strike you are on, Mr. Halleck," he said without turning around. "In many ways, the world is nothing but a pile of shit, but it can also be very beautiful."
He walked toward a blue Chevrolet that was idling at the side of the building and got into the back seat. The car moved off.
"I'm trying to get off of it," Billy said to the disappearing car. "I'm really trying."
He closed the door and walked slowly back to the small table beside his chair. He looked at the medicine bottles and wondered how he was going to open them one-handed. Billy ordered a large lunch sent in. He had never been less hungry in his life, but he ate all of it. When he was done, he risked taking 3 of Fander's Emprin, reasoning that he was putting them on top of a turkey club sandwich, French fries, and a wedge of apple pie that had tasted quite a bit like stale asphalt. The pills hit him hard. He was aware that the pain transmitter in his hand had suddenly been reduced to a mere 5,000 watts, and then he was cavorting through a feverish series of dreams. Gina danced across one of them, naked except for gold hoop earrings. Then he was crawling through a long, dark culvert toward a round circle of daylight that always, maddeningly, stayed the same distance away. Something was behind him. He had a terrible feeling it was a rat, a very large rat. Then he was out of the culvert. If he had believed that would mean escape, he had been wrong. He was back in that starving Fairview. Corpses lay heaped everywhere. Yard Stevens lay sprawled in the middle of the town common, his own barber's shears driven deep into what remained of his throat. Billy's daughter leaned against a lamppost, nothing but a bunch of jointed sticks in her purple and white cheerleader's outfit. It was impossible to tell if she was really dead like the others, or only comatose. A vulture fluttered down and landed on her shoulder. Its talons flexed once, and its head darted forward. It ripped out a great swatch of her hair with its rotting beak. Bloody strands of scalp still clung to the ends, as clumps of earth clung to the roots of a plant which had been roughly pulled out of the ground. And she was not dead. Billy heard her moan, saw her hands stir weakly in her lap. "No!" he shrieked in this dream. He found he had the girl's slingshot in his hand. The cradle was loaded not with a ball bearing, but a glass paperweight that sat on a table in the hall of the Fairview house. There was something inside the paperweight, some flaw, that looked like a blue-black thunderhead. Linda had been fascinated with it as a child. Billy fired the paperweight at the bird. It missed, and suddenly the bird turned into Tadus Lemke. A heavy thudding sound started somewhere. Billy wondered if it was his heart going into a fatal spell of arrhythmia. "I never take it off, white man from town," Lemke said. And suddenly Billy was somewhere else, and the thudding sound was still going on. He looked stupidly around the motel unit, at first thinking this was only another locale in his dreams. "William," someone called from the other side of the door. "Are you in there? Open this up or I'm going to break it in. William! William!" "Okay," he tried to say, and no sound came out of his mouth. His lips had dried and gummed shut. Nevertheless, he felt an overwhelming sense of relief. It was Ginelli.
"William?
Will...
Ah, fuck."
This last was in a lower I'm-talking-to-myself voice, and was followed by a thump as Ginelli threw his shoulder against the door. Billy got to his feet, and the whole world wavered in and out of focus for a moment. He got his mouth open at last, his lips parting with a soft rip that he felt rather than heard.
"That's okay," he managed. "That's okay, Richard. I'm here. I'm awake now."
He went across the room and opened the door.
"Christ, William, I thought you were..."
Ginelli broke off and stared at him, his brown eyes widening and widening until Billy thought, "He's going to run. You can't look that way at anyone or anything and not take to your heels as soon as you get over the first shock of whatever it was." Then Ginelli kissed his right thumb, crossed himself and said,
"Are you going to let me in, William?"
Ginelli had brought better medicine than Fander's, Shivas. He took the bottle out of his calfskin briefcase and poured them each a stiff hooker. He touched the rim of his plastic motel tumbler to the rim of Billy's.
"Happier days than these," he said. "How's that?"
"That's just fine," Billy said, and knocked the shot off in one big swallow. After the explosion of fire in his stomach had subsided to a glow, he excused himself and went into the bathroom. He didn't need to use the toilet, but he did not want Ginelli to see him cry.
"What did he do to you?" Ginelli asked. "Did he poison your food?"
Billy began to laugh. It was the first good laugh in a long time. He sat down in his chair again and laughed until more tears rolled down his cheeks. I love you, Richard," he said when the laughter had tapered off to chuckles and a few shrill giggles. "Everyone else, including my wife, thinks I'm crazy. The last time you saw me, I was 40 pounds overweight, and now I look like I'm trying out for the part of the Scarecrow in the remake of The Wizard of Oz, and the first thing out of your mouth is, 'Did he poison your food?'" Ginelli waved away both Billy's half-hysterical laughter and the compliment with the same impatience. Billy thought,
Ike and Mike, they think alike. Lemke and Janelli, too. When it comes to vengeance and counter-vengeance, they have no sense of humor.
Well, did he?
I suppose that he did. In a way, he did.
How much weight have you lost?
Billy's eyes strayed to the wall-sized mirror across the room. He remembered reading, in a John D. MacDonald novel, he thought, that every modern motel room in America seems filled with mirrors, although most of those rooms are used by overweight businessmen who have no interest in looking at themselves in an undressed state. His state was very much the opposite of overweight, but he could understand the anti-mirror sentiment. He supposed it was his face. No, not just his face, his whole head, which had thrown such a fright into Richard. The size of his skull had remained the same, and the result was that his head perched atop his disappearing body like the hideously oversized head of a giant sunflower.
"I never take it off you, white man from town," he heard Lemke say. "How much weight, William?" Janelli repeated.
His voice was calm, gentle even, but his eyes sparkled in an odd, clear way. Billy had never seen a man's eyes sparkle in quite that way, and it made him a little nervous. "When this began, when I came out of the courthouse and the old man touched me, I weighed 250 pounds. This morning I weighed in at 116 just before lunch. That's what, 134 pounds?
"Jesus, Mary and Joseph the carpenter from Brooklyn Heights," Janelli whispered, and crossed himself again. "He touched you?"
"This is where he walks out. This is where they all walk out," Billy thought, and for one wild second he thought of simply lying, of making up some mad story of systematic food poisoning. But if there had ever been a time for lying, it was gone now. And if Janelli walked, Billy would walk with him, at least as far as Janelli's car. He would open the door for him and thank him very much for coming. He would do it because Janelli had listened when Billy called in the middle of the night and sent his rather peculiar version of a doctor, and then come himself. But mostly,